Hey, you guys, the Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes, more than 550 and counting, are available for free. You can listen to all of it for free. Your support makes a difference. If you would like to support this show, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jesus, dude, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listie.
I don't know.
Hi, everybody.
This is the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listie. I'm in Los Angeles. I have a head cold. Can you hear it? I don't know if you can hear it. I am very pleased to have Morris Collins on the program. His first novel, Horse Latitudes, is out from DeZank Books. And it was the official December pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. TheNervousBreakdown.com is my online culture magazine and literary community. The new editor-in-chief is Joey Grantham. So if you would like to join the book club, you can find out about that at TheNervousBreakdown.com. I interview book club authors here on the program. So Morris and I had a great conversation, and that's coming up just like seconds from now. I don't have much to offer other than to wish you all a happy new year. This is the first episode of 2019. I feel like 2018, it's kind of even hard to talk about. So much craziness, but also a lot of good. And I hope that in 2019, there is some kind of peaceful revolution. Is that too much to hope for? So let's get to the conversation. The first interview of 2019 with Morris Collins. His debut novel, Horse Latitudes, is available now from DeZank Books.
Writing was always important to me, but I didn't really even have a sense going to college. I didn't know what an MFA program was. I certainly didn't have a sense of that. That's what I was going to do. I was a medieval languages major primarily in college. I did a lot of that sort of thing.
What does that even mean? Like Gaelic or like?
Yeah, Middle Welsh, Anglo-Saxon, Middle English, Old English. So yeah, lots of Latin.
So you're fluent? Are you fluent in those languages?
Back in the day, I could read them pretty well. There's no one really to speak to in them, luckily. But the vocabularies often weren't super big. You needed to know who was fighting who.
How did you even get into that?
Yeah, I don't. When I was in high school, actually, my freshman year of high school, I remember over Thanksgiving break, I was reading like some. I think the British writer, actually, Alan Gardner, had rewritten some old Welsh legends for children. And I remember reading some of them and really liking them. And for some reason, I thought to myself, I'm going to teach myself Welsh. And so I started trying to teach myself Welsh in high school. And then I had a teacher in high school who tutored me actually in Anglo-Saxon a little bit. So I started doing it in high school just sort of on my own as an autodidact kind of.
That's unusual.
Yeah, it was. Well, not super popular, but
so. And does this have any like family? Is this some kind of family thing where you're going back to your roots? Like, do you have any like Welsh roots, or is there any kind of like ancestral thing that you wanted to sort of work out?
No, not really. Like, I don't think so. I liked it over there. I'd gone over there a lot. My mom lives in the UK. So I go over pretty frequently, and so I always liked the landscape. I liked Wales a lot, but no, I just got really caught up by the literature and wanted to read it in the original, and so started trying to teach myself.
Oh, interesting. So your mom lives in England?
She does, yeah, Cambridge.
Okay, but is your mom English?
No, so it's backwards. So my parents are separated, but my father is English and immigrated to the United States when he was a kid. My mother is from Louisiana and moved to the UK in 2001.
Wow. So where in the, because my parents are from Louisiana. Where's she from?
New Orleans.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Like it's city proper?
I believe so. Yeah.
Wow. All right. So Like, it sounds like you were a pretty like scholarly kid. Like, if you're trying to like as an autodidact learn what is it, like Anglo-Saxon and Welsh?
Yeah, and Welsh. Yeah.
Like, were you a nerdy kid?
Well, at the same time, I was probably failing half my classes in high school. You know, so I was taking Latin in high school and probably getting a D. I was probably getting a D at the time in math. I was smart. I wasn't a good student in high school. I went to a weird sort of little school in Boston. You know, actually, you know, it has a number of writers came out of there the last few years. Caitlin Greenridge, Otessa Mosfeg, same school.
What school is this?
The Comwell School in Boston. It's a sort of a small private school right downtown. And they were really hard. I did. I followed up my own interests, but I wasn't like a very good student, if that makes sense.
Were you were you getting into trouble?
Not so much in high school. I got kicked out of second grade. So I must have gotten trouble in second grade.
What did you get kicked out of second grade for?
You know, I swear I don't know. It was a Hebrew day school, because those were the only Jews I'd ever really met, because I grew up in an Irish neighborhood. But I don't know. I didn't respond well to rabbinical oversight, I guess.
Were you raised with like a lot of Judaism? Did you have like a bar mitzvah and stuff?
Yeah, I did. I did. Yeah, we were. You know. Yeah, it was a pretty Jewish household. I mean, we did Shabbat every Friday, and yeah, I had bar mitzvah and I went to temple. But I didn't know. I mean, I didn't have a social Jewish life, you know, because everyone in the neighborhood were Irish Catholics, and you know, that was my social life.
Well, and what is Shabbat like? Shabbat's like where you just shut it down. You don't, you like, what is it? What does that even mean?
Yeah, you light candles at night, and you say some prayers, and yeah, you're supposed to just sort of, yeah, exactly. You know, shut it down, be attentive to the moment, a little bit of, I guess it's, you know, it's ancient mindfulness.
Right. That sounds good. Like every Friday.
Yeah. I still try to some degree. Like I'm not, you know, we make some food and light the candles and turn off the phone and, you know, just try to be present in the moment, I guess. Like for me, it's not like a religious component so much as it's, I like the slowing down a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and don't, like, isn't the same thing true for the Sabbath? Isn't there like a certain, I guess it's different sects of Judaism, you know, where you completely, mm-hmm. you don't even use, like in the Orthodox Judaism, you don't even use like any appliances or anything on the Sabbath, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not nearly so fastidious as that. But yes, yeah, you know, Orthodox, certainly they won't use electricity or technology of any kind for the most part. Yeah.
So like, did you grow up like with a strong, like religious belief, or was it more just like, this is a cultural heritage that, you know, cause people have different ways of sort of absorbing that stuff.
Yeah. I don't, you know, I don't know. I still try to figure that out. No, I don't have strong religious belief. I wish I did, but it's not there. I can't, you know, I see the Bible very clearly as literature.
Why do you wish you had religious belief?
I don't know. It sounds comforting, doesn't it? I mean, like, I find any kind of certainty really attractive, and I don't have it.
Yeah, I don't either. I'm the same way. I think I've said similar things before. It's the kind of thing that like non-religious people say with some frequency, where it's like, I wish I could do it. And I think it's because it seems like such a nice thing to be able to like to have, you know, if you really believed it. But I'm not sure if I really do want it unless it's actually rooted in reality. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I don't want to like attach to a myth, or I don't know. It's just, it gets complicated for me. I feel like it's only truly appealing to me if there is a strong foundation of reality. It's not just like, oh, I believe in this story. I don't know if I would want that.
Yeah, no, that's true. And like you have to sort of, I think, rationalize your own entitlement to believe, you know, like because the thing that gets me about significant religious belief is how do you comprehend that all the terrible things that happen? And, you know, and I can't do that. I can't believe that there's somehow someone making those choices and I'm somehow just being spared due to my own righteousness, you know? So yeah, I can't But it would be nice if that were all worked out somehow.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
No, I don't think so.
So I'm fascinated by this high school that you went to, that it's produced all these writers. It sounds like a good school.
Yeah, well, it's produced, like, you know, two pretty famous writers and me. And that was just 3 years, you know. It was really rigorous. Pretty traditional, old-fashioned education, really hard. I mean, I found the grading really hard, but it was a sort of artistic, strange, eclectic bunch of kids.
And how big of a class was it?
Oh, it was tiny. I think the entire school when I was there had about 140 students.
Okay. And like, were you in class with Otessa? Are you guys contemporaries?
So I think Otessa graduated in 98 and I graduated in 2000. So I knew who she was. I didn't even know she wrote. I knew who she was. I didn't really know her. But certainly, you know, it's a very small school. So you saw everyone around.
Well, that's crazy. It's like one of those like sports high schools that like produces like, you know, three pro baseball players or something like really statistically unlikely.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean, Otessa, obviously, you know, and then, you know, Caitlin Greenidge was 99. She was a year just ahead of me and, you know, she's had great success the last few years. So yeah, no, it's. I don't know. I'm not sure. There wasn't much of a writing culture at the school. I mean, at least not that I was aware of.
But you were probably reading a lot. You're probably reading well.
Yeah, constantly. Yeah.
So what were some big books for you as a young person? Like, what got you set on this road?
You know, I don't know because I'm not exactly sure when I decided. I know back then, I think one of the books I read, I'm trying to think, in high school that made a huge effect on me was Ben Okri's novel, The Famished Road. I think it won the Booker Prize, I want to say, in like 94 or something like that. He's a Nigerian author. And it was a beautiful, wild sort of magic realist type of novel. I remember being just like blown away by that in high school, how surreal it was and how beautiful the language was, and probably trying to copy it in all sorts of terrible ways, you know, for a long time.
And then you go up to Rochester.
Yeah, then I was always doing creative writing in Rochester. I was taking creative writing classes every semester, but I was mostly reading and thinking about medieval stuff. But I started writing more and more, and I realized more and more often that like the way I interacted with literature was it made me want to write, or it inspired me to write, or I thought about it from that point of view. So by the time I was leaving Rochester, I sort of decided, yeah, I'm going to try to, you know, privilege writing and do the MFA thing.
What did your parents think of this?
You know, they were okay with that. They were very, very supportive. I mean, I was lucky in that regard. I didn't have any pushback. You know, they thought, okay, go for it. I mean, my father's an academic, so he both thought, you know, okay, fair enough, but also maybe you should try to do something a little bit more stable, like, you know, get a PhD in lit or something like that. But I mean, this was before the whole PhD in creative writing thing had really caught on.
Wait, it caught on? I was not aware of this.
I think there's like 40 or 50 of them in the country. So something's happened.
You can get a doctorate in creative writing.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what that, you know, I feel like that's kind of been hard for the MFA because it's kind of devalued the MFA, or made the MFA sort of change from a terminal degree to something else. But
well, I feel like the academic job market is so competitive in these spaces because it's really the only only natural fit for somebody who's writing or who's interested in writing and wants to have a job with some stability but a flexible schedule that's in their field of interest. Like, you know what I'm saying? And so everybody's applying for this very limited spaces. And if you've got the PhD and somebody else only has the MFA, then I guess that probably gives them the advantage.
Yeah, I think so.
Gives you the advantage.
I think absolutely. I mean, I am in academia, but it's been very hard. I think that's everybody's story. Hmm. Yeah, increasingly.
So what about your novel? Like, how can you talk a little bit about how it came to be? Like, how did you wind up? I mean, you've already talked about your interest in medieval stuff and like these ancient languages or whatever, but how did you wind up with an interest in Central America?
Yeah, it's kind of, so I was, you know, I guess my first year of graduate school, my best friend from college was doing Peace Corps down in Honduras. And he was teaching, he was doing like AIDS education with prostitutes and gang members in prison and stuff like that. And I had some time off and I went to, I won like an essay award and got like $1,000, which was a windfall back then. And I went down and spent some time with him down in Honduras, and he showed me all around, like, you know, the country as he really wanted me to see it, not the tourist parts of the country, which probably don't even exist anymore, but, you know, the where prostitutes were living and gang members were living, and showed me all around there. And he was in this little town that had a sort of, I guess it used to be a U.S. military base there. I'm not sure if the military base was even still there, but like in the 80s when they were, you know, staging counter-revolutionary Contra stuff into Nicaragua, they would train there. So there was a huge former U.S. military presence there, and which meant there was like a whole bunch of creepy old, like 50, 60-year-old former Marines down in this little town in Honduras with like 16-year-old girlfriends, and this very sort of, you know, girlfriend is probably a euphemistic term, but this, you know, really creepy, terrifying expat culture there.
Jesus.
Yeah, it was really sad and horrifying. And like, you know, the town was, you know, the whole area was very much on the edge of just like falling into terrible crime, violence, poverty. And it got a lot worse after that. I mean, Peace Corps ended up pulling out of Honduras, but, you know, you would walk through town and, you know, I've got blondish hair, blue eyes, so did my friend. And people would literally be stopping you every moment on the street saying, you know, will you give me a blue-eyed baby? Will you live with me? Will you, you know, and which was incredibly, you know, sad as a sort of an echo of colonialism or whatever. But there were plenty of people down there taking advantage of that. And so I spent a while down there and got interested in sort of that scene. And then later that year, we were a bunch of us from grad school going down to AWP, you know, the big writers conference, which was going to be in Austin. And we got there about a week early and ended up going down to Mexico for a week, to a border town there. And so I spent some time traveling there as well.
What border town?
Nuevo Laredo.
Oh, okay. What did you do there?
So there wasn't that much to do there, in that it was pretty, I guess it was on the edge of also, it was a pretty violent time. I think the last mayor of the town at that point had lasted 8 hours before being assassinated, and no one had replaced him, unsurprisingly. But yeah, we went down there, and like, there's basically what that town is it used to be a big source of shopping and knockoff drugs for old people from Texas, but it had got so sort of violent, there was really no one there anymore. And then also what there was a huge walled compound there called Boys Town, which is sort of legal prostitution, where you have these Central American migrants who have been coming up, sort of trafficked up by coyotes from Guatemala and Honduras and places like that, and haven't quite made it, you know, to the border, and have sort of been coerced into this terrifying sort of compound. And so basically we get there and people just try to like either take you to Boys Town or sell you drugs. So, you know, you get there and they say, hey, do you want to go to Boys Town? Like, there'd be like a 6-year-old with a donkey cart, and he'd say, hey, do you want to go to Boys Town? Say, no, I don't really want to go to Boys Town. And he'd sort of look at you and say, okay, well then do you want Viagra? You know, it was assuming like a causal relationship. I was like, no, don't want Viagra either. Okay, well, do you want Xanax? You know, and
you're like, actually, I'll take a couple.
Yeah, actually, at this point, Xanax would be just about what I need. It was not a good town.
So you spent a week there just to like investigate. Was this part of book research? Like, were you consciously
At that point, yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, if it sounds like such a bleak place to be, why would you want to even like voluntarily go there unless you're researching a book or, you know, you're doing some sort of aid work or something? Or you're going to Boys Town.
Yeah, right. And I was there with, you know, some other writers from grad school. One of the people I was there with was like an Amish poet who I think she was disastrously high the entire time.
Wait, it was just a high Amish poet?
I think so, yeah. And
what's her name? Can we out her or no?
I'm going to keep that under wraps, I think.
Damn. I want to interview her.
She's out there. But she was spending the whole time trying to buy a sombrero for her cat. and it was like, you know, no one is wearing a sombrero. There's no other tourists here. Please stop trying to buy a sombrero for your cat.
Was she actively Amish, or was it like she's like formerly Amish? Like
No. Formerly, her you know, her family was. She was not actively.
Yeah, you don't. You're not actively Amish if you're looking for a cat sombrero.
No, probably not. I don't know though.
So you're down there with an inebriated Amish poet yourself. You're doing research. Are you interviewing people on the street? Or are you just kind of soaking it in? Like, what does it actually look like in practice?
No, we were drinking, I think, primarily. I'm trying to remember. Like, this was 2005 or 2006. But yeah, we were just traveling around. I mean, we were eating, talking to people. Yeah, we talked to people in restaurants and stuff like that. There wasn't much going on there. I mean, like, I think gang warfare had taken a real toll on the city. So there wasn't a lot of commerce.
And then what about Honduras? You said you spent some time down there. Like, what does that mean? Like, how much time?
I don't remember exactly. I mean, I think, you know, around a month, you know, I 2005, 2006, you know, with my friend who was working down there. So, you know, we traveled through the city, and at that point I wasn't going there, looking to research. I was just going down there to, you know, see what the country was like. But traveling throughout it, I sort of realized by the time I left that I wanted to write about it.
What was it specifically that made you want to write about it?
I don't know. It would be sort of retrospective. I think I was really struck though by sort of the bleakness of all those American expats down there, sort of just living these really disastrous sort of lives. I mean, they were just drinking themselves unconscious, sort of being exploitative in the, you know, with, you know, literally there'd be like 50-year-old guys with 16-year-old girlfriends. Yeah, it was just a weird subculture.
I got to be honest, I didn't realize that was happening. Like, I know there's expats. I know that there's like little communities of retirees. Like, that was always my vision of it. Like, you know, retirees looking for like a cheap, like beachfront, retirement will go to like Panama or something like that. But I didn't know that there's like creepy pedophile Marines.
Yeah, no, there definitely is. There's a sort of military presence down there, or ex-military, sort of creepy presence, or there was back then. I have no idea if it's still at large, but I imagine, I mean, I think things like sex tourism don't really go away.
So did you delve into the history of American intervention in Central America? Did you have to get into a lot of research to try to make sense of this? I mean, imagine to get context and to figure out why these people are down there and what the legacy is, you probably had to do some reading.
Yeah, and I was sort of thinking about it then because, you know, these were the Bush years. You know, this 2000, I guess this was 2005, 2006. I wrote the book, actually, 2007, 2008. So, like, yeah, these are the Bush years when we were sort of seeing sort of the failure of American sort of imperial imagination in the Middle East, right? Like, we had this sense of maybe, and this is, maybe it was just more cynical than this, but there was this sort of ideology and practice and just creating terrible vacuums and violence in these countries. And that's sort of what happened in Central America as well, you know, and from the starting in the 50s in Guatemala, probably, and then into the 80s, certainly, and, you know, Nicaragua, and then Honduras had a coup later in 2009 that, you know, was more or less tacitly supported by the United States. So, and, you know, into the structural or infrastructural craters left by the CIA, basically, in those countries, you got, you know, gang warfare, unsurprisingly, just like, you know, sort of in Iraq as well. So,
yeah, you obviously want democracy to spread. You know, you want countries to be liberated from dictators, like authoritarians, including our own currently.
Yeah, God willing.
You know, but I guess it's an interesting thought project to contemplate, you know, when it comes to how do you, like, what's the best way for a country to try to spread democratic values? Like, it can't be through the barrel of a gun. I don't think that tends to work all that well. I think we have, like, the evidence would appear to be in, and, you know, otherwise, what do you do? You know, I guess you funnel money through back channels, or you, I don't know. But I think about that sometimes when I contemplate, say, for example, the Middle East, or you contemplate, you know, any like military dictatorship around the world. Like, what do you do as an outside actor to try to get things to head in a better direction? Or do you have a responsibility to do that? Do you just leave them alone and let them figure it out for themselves?
I mean, yeah, I have no idea, though. I think in Central America, I mean, it wasn't even that we weren't leaving them alone. We were trying to maintain, like, you know, mining interests and fruit interests, you know, the fruit companies, you know, trying to basically look out for our own corporate interests in those countries. So sort of reinforcing authoritarian and right-wing governments in those places, because, and the excuse was, we're trying to stave off communism, but, you know, also trying to maintain American business interest in those areas. That's reductive, obviously, but.
Well,
you know,
I think Gore Vidal wrote a novel about that years and years ago. It was set in, I want to say, Guatemala. I want to say he lived down in Guatemala for like a short spell, but got to lay eyes on exactly that. It was like United Fruit Company or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. United Fruit owned, like, you know, in Honduras, United Fruit, you know, in some middle of the century, owned basically all the arable land. You know, so the actual citizens of the country couldn't grow any of the crops that they were exporting.
Oh my God. Well, you know, did you come to any conclusions, like, as an outgrowth of writing your book? Did you have any like epiphanies about, you know, American imperialism or its use of its power or corporate, you know, corporate influence?
You know, I wish I did. I mean, I think we can we can suggest that American imperialism is not a very good idea and is morally bankrupt. And it is not really, and I guess be wary of any ideology that suggests that it's somehow righteous. But no, I mean, I think certainty in these situations is very dangerous, especially when reinforced by morality or, you know, self-righteousness, I guess. You know, having said that, I think, you know, when a country's using its military to reinforce its own capitalist interests in other countries, it's probably not the best thing.
Right. Right.
Hence Saudi Arabia right now, right? Our relationship with them.
Well, yeah, everything's so fucked up. And I find myself at the same, like, in a similar vein, I can find myself reading about, say, an uprising happening, you know, in a country where there's, you know, people who are like agitating for democracy and trying to organize and, you know, thinking about like, well, we should help these people, you know, and sometimes America, when I guess its interests aren't necessarily, you know, at stake, or we're not somehow fully invested because we don't have enough of an economic interest. Usually it's like, are we being negligent by not helping, or is it not our place to help? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, I can understand sort of the impulse to want to help those people in these places where they're oppressed, but it's hard to know exactly what it's supposed to look like.
I think there's a danger probably in having, you know, one size fits all policy with, you know, intervention. I mean, certainly it would have been good had we intervened in Rwanda a lot sooner.
Right. Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Or, you know, in, you know, to shut down the concentration camps in, you know, World War II. I mean, there's a million examples where, you know, probably perhaps arguably in Syria recently, I don't know. I think it's probably a situation where each situation is distinct and, you know, you can't have a generic policy for use of force.
So what about the publication? So you write this book over a period of years. Like, how long did it take you?
So I wrote this book quickly, you know, more quickly than I've written anything else. I think I wrote it, I think I started writing it like December of 2006, and I probably finished it, you know, in 2008. So yeah, I mean, I wrote it very quickly for me anyway. You know, and then it was actually my MFA thesis, and it was the first novel I'd ever like written or finished. And then the economy collapsed, and I sort of held on to it because I didn't really know what to do with it right then. And I probably started sending it out finally in 2011, 2012, which is when it got accepted the first time. This is actually the second time it's come out.
So wait, when the economy collapsed, like book publishers, like I guess they retracted too. They weren't out accepting novels as often as they usually would.
That was my sense anyway. I mean, I didn't know, but yeah, it seemed like everything had slowed down and they were, you know, I didn't really know what to do with it at the time. So I just kind of held on to it for a few years before.
And then what happened?
It's kind of a weird, like, so then I think, so I finally sent it to a press in 2011. They accepted it in 2012. It came out 2013 the first time with a press that was out of San Francisco that was sort of linked to McAdam Cage, which was at that point a San Francisco indie that was up, just about to die, basically, about to go bankrupt. And my press basically went bankrupt as my book was coming out, you know.
Fortuitous.
Right, yeah. So we printed, you know, lots of ARCs. I went to Winter Institute in Kansas City, you know, met with lots of booksellers and everything. And then the press basically just died. So it got a lot of distribution, but no publicity or anything like that. And it disappeared pretty quickly. And then luckily, DeZank picked it up for a second go. And that was, I think, that was probably back in 2014. But it's, you know, these things take a long time.
Right, to come to fruition. So yeah, so this is this book is a decade old.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like someone else's book. I look back on it, and you know, it's actually a good way for a book to come out because I don't have any kind of emotional hang-ups or sense of self wrapped up in something I wrote when I was 24.
It's like you're promoting somebody else's book.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Okay. And so, what does your writing routine look like? Like, you've obviously been working on other stuff since then.
Yeah, I spent like the following like 9 years writing another book, a second book that took me, you know, forever to write. I finished that a couple years ago. I've been doing something else since then. I get up early. I'm a morning writer. So I try to get up at like 4 a.m., which, you know, sucks. But I get up between four and five every day and try to get a little time in before I have to do all the things that we have to do during the day.
What does the window look like? You're like at your desk by 4:30 and you work until...
You know, it depends because I teach about an hour at a school about an hour from my house. So the commute there is sometimes I'll get up, you know, I'll go into work really early, try to get into the office by 6 a.m. or whatever and spend a couple hours, you know, working there before I have to start prepping for class or something like that. I try like everyone else with a job, right? Like there's all sorts of other things that come up and then you've got life and email and, you know, whatever else is going on. But I try to get a few hours in the mornings, you know, one way or the other.
And what's the novel that took you 9 years?
Yeah, you know, it's totally different than Horse Latitudes. It's a comic novel. It's written about, you know, someone who grew up in Boston. I was trying to take on American identity or New England identity. That's why it took so long, because it was like really long in three different voices. It was about like what it means to be an American and how we define ourselves and what narratives and what stories we tell to, you know, define ourselves there. And so it was looking at, you know, the immigrant experience, like what you see in a lot of like coming of age, picaresque Jewish American novels. And then it shifts gears really radically halfway through to look at, the colonial war of, King Philip's War, which was took place in the 1670s, which was the most bloody war in American history, actually per capita, between colonists and the Native Americans living in New England, and how we sort of shaped New England and America based on the way we talk about that war.
Well, wait, I don't even like this is a blind spot for me. So tell me about this. The bloodiest war per capita in American history?
Yeah, apparently. It was there was a war between, you know, the colonists, the settlers in, you know, Massachusetts primarily, and the Native American tribes living there, and it was incredibly violent, and it was probably sort of instigated by the colonists just to start a war, depending on you know, who you talk to. But it was the offshoot of the war was that much of Massachusetts burned. I mean, the colonies were set back 100 years in terms of infrastructure after this war, and the Native American tribes in Massachusetts and Maine were absolutely decimated. But it was just this incredibly violent war that, yeah, no one talks about. We don't learn about it in school. We don't discuss it. And basically the way it was written about afterwards basically wrote it out of history, the people who did write histories of it wrote it as sort of a righteous, of course, Christian sort of colonization of savagery. But, you know, that was obviously not true.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. What's the old saying? Like, the winners write history or whatever. The victors get to write the history.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you're tying
that into a more, like, it's a, you're jumping around in time. There's like a more contemporary story of like a Boston.
Yeah. And it's hard to imagine that this book has not yet found a home. It's a coming of age picaresque novel, about a Boston caddy, who gets hired by, a member at an old Boston country club where he caddies a lot to find his daughter who's disappeared. And when he finds the daughter, it turns out that, you know, she's from a very old Boston family that was actually that gained all of its wealth by helping create this war and start this war in the 1670s. And so the second half of this novel takes place up in, you know, sort of the Native American reservations up in Maine that I went and traveled to, you know, when I was researching it, where, you know, it's sort of like the remnants of the cultural echo of what happened back then.
And it's still reverberating to at least to some extent.
Well, I mean, it certainly is in terms of, like, you know, economic decline and poverty. I mean, in the years when this novel is taking place, you know, 2009, I think the reservation I was looking at, I think the average life expectancy was 49 years old.
Jesus.
Which was, there wasn't a country in the world that had a 49-year-old life expectancy.
What would you, because of alcohol?
I think because of, like, a lot of converging factors. There's alcohol and drug abuse. And then, like, up, you know, that part of Maine in general is, you know, has its problems with poverty and drugs and all that. But also, I just think health and sickness and depression. And, yeah, I mean, it's way up there. It's a bleak part of Maine. And, like, I'm not trying to suggest that, like, obviously, when you write about Native American reservations, you got to be careful not to fall into ruin porn or something like that. There are all these cliches of the genre. On the other hand, you know, this was a reality in a place that was 250 miles from Boston, and, you know, no one even talks about it.
So what do? You drive up there and then you just, like, say, hey, I'm here. I want to check it out. Do you have somebody show you around? Like, how do you do the research?
Yeah, I did. I drove up. I went to the reservation. I met some people. I talked to people. I just talked about, you know, there's not much of the book that was set there. So it wasn't even like, I think I needed the research for the writing of the book. I needed it to sort of feel comfortable to do the writing, if that makes sense. Just, I wanted to, if I was going to write about people, I wanted to, or write about a situation, I wanted to actually talk to people who were there and see what it was like. You know, and it's an area where, like, you know, there's not a very big local economy. There's a lot of blueberry picking, which is seasonal. There's sort of logging. There's a little bit of fishing, but there's not a lot else up there.
It's pretty up in Maine, though. I like Maine in the summer.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, it's beautiful. This is way up there. This is very bleak, though. Yeah, gorgeous. I mean, desolate.
So it sounds like you really like experiential research. Like, it seems like it's been a factor in at least two of your books, the first two.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I end up doing all this research and then not really using it. But I feel like I need to see things and to just get a visual sense and to obviously meet people and talk to people just so I feel that I'm getting it right to some degree, that I'm not just falling into cliche or into some kind of cultural expectation that I'd have without even realizing it.
Well, and also it allows you to give yourself permission to then create fictions in these places and with these people. And I can understand that. Like, I've talked to writers on this show before who have written fiction set in distant lands or whatever that they never visited. They just, like, looked at pictures on Google and watched videos and just kind of took it from there. And I don't know if I could do that. I sort of feel like if I'm going to write a place or if I'm going to write people, I need to have boots on the ground and actually like experience it a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I would feel bad about that. I'd also feel like there are things that you wouldn't even notice, or you wouldn't even know you're not noticing. I mean, I guess you can make it up too. And like the part of my novel that's set up in Maine is like narrated by an insane former pedophile classicist living on a houseboat, who's, you know, survived a tornado when he was young and so bleeds from his ears and stuff like, so it's very weird and silly and strange voice anyway. So there's plenty of interjection of imagination there, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like you need to at least know what it's like to be in that place a little bit.
Well, you know, I say this though, and the person I'm thinking of, had I not spoken about this issue, I would have never known that they hadn't gone there. It seemed completely believable in their fiction. So I guess it can be done.
Oh yeah. I mean, as I said, I think most of the stuff that I actually see and take notes on, I don't ever use. You just have to, you know, it's one of those things that you have to give yourself permission, I think, to write. And it's one of those things I need to give myself permission, even if, it wasn't that necessary in the first place.
Is there a favorite part of the writing process for you? Like, do you love editing or do you love drafting, or is there something that comes most easily to you?
None of it comes easily. I like revising. I mean, I hate drafting. I hate it. It's torture.
Do you work on like a word count?
You know, I used to. So I did with Horse Latitudes. I tried doing like 500 words a day or whatever. But then with the second novel, which took me 9 years or whatever, no, I tried, but I was just so slow. I mean, I feel like a good day of writing is 500 words, but that's very rare.
Do you, but you obviously are able to keep going. Like, do you ever get so frustrated you feel like thrown in the towel?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I get very frustrated. I don't know what I would do if I threw in the towel. You know,
right. At this point,
you know, I've sort of doubled down on this life at this point. I better keep doing it. But taking 9 years to write a book was horrible. You know, if it took me that long to write the next one,
I've got you beat. I'm like in double digits.
It's terrible, right?
Yeah. I'm like, it's just haunting me. It's been haunting me for a decade of my life.
Yeah. You need like momentum. I feel like momentum, it helps you just stay in it and stay, because you know, you change, right? Like you start writing and 5 years later, you're an entirely different person. What you want from the book has changed because you've changed, and it's hard to stay like know which, what to let change and what to hang on to.
Yeah, that's a good point, you know, because you talk about Horse Latitudes and how it feels like it's somebody else's book. I can relate to that. And then if you spend too long on a book, then, you know, you wind up, it seems inevitable that you would wind up making major changes to it because you've changed so significantly. It's hard to stay related to your book in the same way over that long of a period of time.
Yeah, and like, I was struggling, but you know, for years, the reason the second one took me so long, I was trying to do something that wasn't working. I was trying to write the whole book from one point of view, and it, years and years and years I spent doing that. And then like, it just wasn't working. I couldn't hit all the registers I needed to hit. And then like one day, like 7 years in, I realized, oh, I could just write it in three different points of view and problem solved, and became an immensely better book immediately. And then it was easy to finish, but it took me a long time to realize something very simple.
So, and now, but that book is out there on the market trying to find a home.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the only thing I've ever written that I felt immediately comfortable with when I wrote it, which is a good thing, but it's also kind of maybe it's a bad thing too, cause I'm probably not as objective about it as I should be, but yeah, it's out there for those people who want coming of age, picaresque, humorous novels about America, but also about colonial wars and America's history.
Yeah, also about the bloodiest war per capita in the history of the country.
Yeah, one of those comedies.
Wow. And how long is this thing? I feel like if 9 years, it's got to be like 800 pages, but maybe I'm wrong.
The first draft was like 750 pages. I've got it down for anyone who's listening to 500 pages now, a very manageable word count.
Wow.
But yeah, the first one was extraordinarily long.
And what are you working on? What's the third book? You got another one?
Yeah, I'm about 100 pages into a book. It's about Holocaust survivors and sort of coming to terms with intergenerational trauma that comes out of, you know, having parents or grandparents who survived the Holocaust, but having this sort of downloaded trauma and dread that you don't even understand. And it's supposed to be a comedy. So
That's interesting, though, because I've had conversations with Jewish friends of mine about this very subject. You know, even though they are generationally removed from the horrors of the Holocaust, and even if they didn't necessarily have like grandparents who were in camps or who had to escape in some sort of really like harrowing way, just culturally, you know, the knowledge of that is that there's a lot of heavy baggage to carry for anybody who's Jewish and in these times, right? Or in any, you know, ever since then.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, as with so many people, I mean, like, you know, Trump has made all this come right back to the fore. I mean, what has seemed theoretical, it suddenly seems, you know, possible again. You understand how societies sort of degrade themselves so quickly.
Right, right. And, you know, I was thinking too, more broadly about the psychic toll that these past 2 years, you know, past 3 years, I guess, if you count the run up to the election, like what is the psychological toll at a collective level, you know, of Trump and all that he has done to, I think, degrade the country, its institutions, the national discourse, you know, all of it. It's just, I think that this has been monumental in terms of its impact, but I don't think we necessarily, or at least I don't necessarily have a clear view of what it means for me and then what it means like on a broader scale.
No. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're constantly living in shock, right? It's like, you know, my friend calls it like slow, dull shocks. I mean, like we should be stunned, but like we're just constantly in a state of horror. And that's, you know, that's if you're lucky. That's if you're privileged and it's primarily intellectual. I mean, you know, there's plenty of people who are being viscerally endangered by this administration and the people who support it, which is equally terrifying. I mean, my wife's family is from central Pennsylvania, and I know just traveling into central Pennsylvania to
wait, is your wife the high Amish poet? Are you trying to like protect
no,
her?
No, no, my wife is not the high Amish poet. She is not Amish. I don't think she's high right now.
I'm going to float that conspiracy theory for everybody listening. Morris is married to a high Amish poet.
fair enough. That, well, you know. Not yet.
Well, I think what you got to do though is I think you got to get back into your MMA training, and you have to draw upon your heritage. You know, your grandfather. We got to like, because like this is a question. It's like at some point the Trump era is going to end, hopefully sooner than later. And then what happens to all those like MAGA people after that? Like what happens to all these white supremacist movements and militias and all the crazy people who are on board?
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, like, one would hope they go back where they came from, right? But I don't know. I think it depends on how this actually happens. I'd like to believe that he will not last out the rest of his term, but I have no idea.
What do you do with them though? Like, it's like these people have like, I feel like there's been a rock that's sort of been overturned, and there's all these like potato bugs under it. You know what I'm saying? When you do that, there's worms, and you're just like, oh. I had no idea. And I think that, I guess you knew that there was that element in this country. I don't know if I knew that it was as pervasive, as it has become, or it was sort of like festering there and then he enabled it and it just, you know, it brought new people into the ranks or whatever. But how do we address that? And like, how do we medicate that? If that's the right word.
I think we have to stop fetishizing understanding. I mean, like, there's all, and I understand this, but in the wake of the election, there's all these sort of think pieces, like, how did we get there? How did we get here? Now, immediately, we're talking about the next election, and we're talking about how are we going to court, you know, white male voters in Michigan or whatever, you know, whatever demographic you want. And it's kind of like, I cannot understand how someone can look at Trump and support him. And I don't think. Understanding necessarily is the way to go there. I think we need to sort of move forward with a progressive policies, a wider base, including more people. I don't know, because how do you deal with it, right? How do you look at someone who supported Trump and supported this administration and say, you know, your values are important to me?
Right, right. Like, I want to try to bring you into the fold. I think you just you have to kind of talk right over them. Like anybody who's like deeply on board with this agenda, you know, I don't think you shouldn't really pay much attention. You don't necessarily have to get into some sort of, like, I'm speaking from the perspective of a candidate. Like, I don't know if you necessarily need to get down into the mud and have some sort of like verbal battle with them, but it's just like, kind of ignore it and just talk right over. Or is that not the strategy?
I don't know. I don't think you ever grant the premise, right? I don't think anything that they stand for or believe in is legitimate. And I don't think they think it's legitimate. Like, I don't think they actually believe, like, these people weren't desiring a wall 10 years ago.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I was at the border. Like, it's a fantasy, and it's not a real issue. It's just, it's an excuse to vent hatred or anger or disappointment or what, you know, I don't know. I don't even know how to psychologize that kind of, pathology.
Have you ever thought about writing a book about this? I think everybody living through these times who's a writer is like, well, what would I ever say? The farthest that I've gotten is just like keeping some sort of diary, which I have not gotten around to doing, but I wish I would have, like, especially going back to like day one, I wish I would have just written a diary of these times and then tried to make something out of that. And, you know, in the aftermath, but, have you ever thought about it?
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I'm reading a diary right now by the Romanian writer Mihail Sebastian, who survived the Holocaust in Romania. And I'm reading his diary from the fascist years in Romania. And he writes every day about what he's feeling. And it's amazingly prescient. And he's got amazing perspective on it. I try to do something like that. And I'm just sort of incoherent with rage and disgust. You know? I think my book would just basically be me saying, fuck you. Like, what I'm writing now is trying to. I'm trying to write about the Holocaust. I'm trying to write about, it's set in the first year of Trump. I'm trying to write about, you know, anti-Semitism and Tea Party, you know, stuff. But it's hard to get the perspective on, you know, what's going on right now.
Well, and I'll say this, you know, they've been, like, I feel like I've seen on Twitter or on the internet polls lately that show that like an alarming percentage of American citizens don't even know what the Holocaust was, or have these like incredible like historical blind spots. And in the past, I've said to myself, like, my God, there's like so many, like, you flick through Netflix and it's like there's so many Holocaust documentaries and so many movies made, and you go like, you know, oh my God, like, I don't know if I can watch another one. But then it's like, if people aren't remembering this or it's not being taught, it sort of underscores to me the critical importance of telling and retelling and reconstituting and redelivering these stories so that people don't forget. Because, like, as we've seen, like, societies can slip and the deterioration can happen faster than you would think.
Yeah, it is. It is amazing how fast it happens. And I mean, as you point out, there, I don't know how people aren't aware of the things that are out there. And it almost feels willful. I mean, like, you know, you say, how do people believe all of Trump's lies when it's very clear that he's lying? Like, he says, my crowd was this size, and you're like, well, there's a photo. It wasn't. But like, so it almost feels like the desire not to hear or think or address these things is almost willful.
But we also, you know, we talk about how fast things happen, and maybe it like accelerated over the past 2 or 3 years, like this, you know, mm-hmm. the speed ratcheted up. But I feel like that's kind of a fallacy, because it feels to me like this moment that we're living in is something that we've been building to over decades. And there are all these different circumstances and conditions that presented themselves that contributed to it. Like, it's actually very complex. It's not just like one or two or three factors that, you know, commingled and produced this result. It's dozens and dozens and dozens of different things over long periods of time. And, you know, all the conditions sort of, lined up, and now here we are. Like, does that feel accurate?
Yeah, that certainly seems accurate, in that like Trump and Trumpism are certainly an effect, not a cause, and a complex effect. I don't know. It's sort of like with Brexit too, though, right? I feel like these are self-inflicted wounds. I mean, like, they're happening in the midst of a kind of strong economy. They're happening in peacetime. The conditions that are leading to this sort of extremism both here and in Europe are not necessarily what they were, you know, in, say, the 20s or the 30s. Like, it feels complex, but it also feels very unnecessary.
Well, it feels like a Russian op to me.
Yeah, and that too.
I mean, I think it's been in both cases. It's the same op. It's just different, you know, different... it's different targets, but I feel like Brexit and what happened to us in 2016 are two parts of the same op. Like, they're trying to fuck with Western democracy through information warfare and hacking and all this stuff. So
yeah, but when did they get so good at it?
I feel like information warfare and psychological warfare, you know, Russia has been good at for a long time, but I feel like it's this, you know, the rise of social media and technology and hacking and all that kind of stuff. I mean, obviously that's more contemporary, but they fuse the two. I feel like social media is just like, that really is one of the linchpins of the whole thing, just because of the access it gives you in terms of people's data and their behaviors and their psychological profiles. But then also just the way we live now, like, people's eyeballs are on that stuff all day long. It's very easy to influence people by manipulating what's on their Facebook wall. And I think that, you know, what's scary about it is that it can feel very subtle. You know, I don't think people necessarily realize, even people who have their wits about them, you know, you don't even realize that what you're clicking on or what you're liking or what you're responding to is actually some sort of op. You know, somebody's posted that on your screen who has, you know, malintent. So it feels like a huge problem. And it feels like these, so especially Facebook, you know, they have they've sort of sold us all out and taken the money. And I think we're gonna, you know, we keep finding out more and more and more dark stories about what they were up to. And I don't know, I feel like there's gonna have to at some point be consequences.
Well, maybe we're living in the consequences now.
Well, but I mean, like, there's going to have to be consequences, yeah, for the people in executive, yeah, roles at that company for what the, you know, what's happened, because it seems like they knew what was going on to a large extent, yeah, and let it happen.
Yeah.
So anyway, I could get up on a soapbox about Facebook. <if I would. laughs> So you're 100 pages into your third book. Your first book has been reissued by DeZank. Your second book, which sounds like a magnum opus, is out there, waiting to be scooped up. Is there anything else on your plate creatively, or is this it? Like, are you working on a script or something? Do you have a television pilot?
You know, doesn't everyone? I keep thinking, if, you know, I've got a television pilot, I've got an outline for a series. I think, you know, maybe I'll write it, but no, I gotta finish the third novel faster this time. I'm gonna, you know, put my head down and not take 9 years, because it's not supposed to be that hard.
Yeah, cheers to that.
yeah, you too.
Right, it's great. It's great to talk to you. I'm glad we got to, you know, spotlight your book in the book club this month. And I appreciate your time, and I wish you well on your work.
Yeah, thanks very much, Brad. It's been an honor to talk to you.
Okay, that is Morris Collins. His debut novel, Horse Latitudes, is available from DeZank Books. You can find him online at morriscollins.com. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle on Twitter is at Morris A. Collins. Thanks to Kill Rock Stars and the band Stereo Total for the theme song music, and thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. If you would like to download the Other People app, this show has its own official app. It's free. Go get that wherever you get your apps. If you would like to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. If you want to support the show, patreon.com/otherpplpod. All right, Twiggy, say Happy New Year. She's growling at the neighbor's dogs. Okay, guys, Happy New Year. We'll talk to you soon.